This episode series was done in partnership with and sponsored by Showtime.
William Rickerson, who was 76 years old and was murdered on December the 3rd, 1997.
Charles Perrault, murdered February 20th, 1998.
Deputy Kevin Tarsia, he was 36 years old. He was murdered July 4th, 2002. Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, former criminal behavioral analyst at New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And here we are. This is the most important episode, in my opinion.
Of this series... of our coverage of the Showtime original series, Escape at Dannemora. Today, we're going to talk about the victims of the crimes that put Sweat and Matt behind bars for the rest of their lives.
So episode 6 is a really important one where we get the reveal about what Matt and Sweat have actually done, their crimes, and the fact that they are such dangerous men. So we want to pay tribute to the families of those who were murdered, but also to honour the names of those who were murdered and their lives. And I know with this particular show, you can run the risk, can't you, of romanticising the characters, that we can almost be rooting for them to escape.
Well, we do know that Brett Johnson and Michael Tolkien, this was important to them, that we don't romanticize these offenders. And I think that's the genius of the structure, why episode 6 is kind of perfectly placed, because if you remember in episode 5, these guys are on the run, you know, they've just broken out, and you expect the next episode to be about them getting caught or, you know, them trying to survive. But no, in a genius way, we open with this standalone episode. We flash back to Sweat, Matt, and Tilly, you know, before they all met each other and before they came to Clinton Correctional.
Well, I just want to add that there are different levels of depravity in life. The crimes that they committed that ended up getting them put into a maximum security prison for life, those crimes were incredibly brutal and incredibly heinous. And although there are some actually really great actors portraying them on this show, the men who they are depicting are very, very bad people.
They are, and this isn't Shawshank Redemption. That's not what this is about. These murders, you know, were brutal, you know, very serious crimes. They got a very severe punishment. The death penalty was taken off the table vis-a-vis Sweat. That's the opening for episode 6, where we see Kevin Tarsia, the sheriff's deputy at Broome County, in his car. And, you know, we know that it's a flashback and it's a very graphic scene that unfolds, that he's there doing speed testing and then he gets the bolo about, you know, being on the lookout for a pickup truck. And you see him go and see his partner, his wife, and then he goes back out again. And that's when things start to unfold in the early hours of July the 4th at around 3:45 a.m.
First of all, I want to shout out to Jim Parrick, who plays Officer Tarsa, he almost has no lines in this entire sequence, but you just get to know him in such an amazing way. And this, I know this was important to the writers, that they just show the normal, almost drudgery that it takes, all of the mundanities of this job.
Right, but it not only showed that, it showed the humanity of him and the people that he serves. I think what the writers and Ben Stiller brought out was that when you are a deputy in a small town, there are so many things that you do. You're the dog catcher, you're the person who saves the cat, you're the person who checks in on old people who aren't doing well, you stop motorists who are driving dangerously, and you risk your life every single minute that you're on the job.
Well, that's the thing. Every single time he stops, you think, oh no, what's going to happen? He goes into the bodega to get some mustard, and you're like, oh God, there's going to be a robbery or something. Can I just point out, though, that when he pulls the girl and the dad over for the first-time drivers, he says, parallel parking. It's a lost art. I thought that was a great little gem to show his sort of, you know, sardonic side. It was just
the moments of humanity. And I think, you know, his colleagues also said that they remembered him as an officer who balanced being a perfectionist with generosity and humor. Mm-hmm. So that part, Lisa, you know, bringing out his character, even in the small scenes that he has. He was a family man. He had three brothers and two sisters. And, yeah. You know, obviously they've located it on July 4th, obviously Independence Day, which now for that family has a very different meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every Absolutely. Time it comes around.
So let's talk about that depiction. So he's almost at the end of his shift. And then just about as he's about to get home, he sees some kind of activity off to the side of the road. And now we know something really bad is going to happen. There's this violin music that kicks in. And it's just a merciless, ruthless execution. I mean, I don't see how you can call it anything else.
Right. And it goes beyond the fact that at first he's shot and incapacitated. He could have left well enough alone. I mean, obviously, he was not going to be pursued by Deputy Tarzia because he was incapacitated.
So we're talking about David Sweat. So Officer Tarzia comes upon David Sweat and two other offenders. They've just robbed a gun store, fireworks store, and they're moving their loot into another car. And he comes across them, and they just take him out. Apparently what actually happened, Laura, if you want to comment on this, two of the offenders ran into the woods. David Sweat rolled underneath his car, got his gun, two guns, one Glock and one other semi-automatic weapon, and immediately fired upon the officer when he gets out of his car. Immediately drops him. And at that point they could have left, but that's not what happened.
No, and depending on which accounts you read, but he was shot between 15 and 22 times, which, you know, is overkill, isn't it, Jim? It's not required.
It just shows the depravity, the depraved indifference to human life that they just took to the extreme. I mean, they literally riddled him with bullets and then drove over him with the car.
It was
the most difficult scene in this entire series. And unfortunately, the families have to deal with that every time. I'm sure they're well aware of what their father and their husband and their friend went through. And it's terrible.
And actually, you know, this is the first officer shot in the line of duty in the department's 196-year history. So that also says something about the town, the location itself. That, you know, this was something that had never happened before. So Kevin Tarsier, 36 at the time, he acted as a hero. He saw them. He'd already been given a be on the lookout for, and he didn't wait for other people. Maybe there wasn't backup. Maybe there wasn't somebody else that he could call upon to help him. We don't know how many officers there were who were working that night, but I got the sense it pretty much was probably him, right? And he didn't think about his safety in terms of doing his job to protect and serve.
Right. And usually on nights like that, a holiday night, it would be sort of a skeleton crew. But the police, they work 365 days a year, 366 on leap years. And the problem is that when something goes down like this, you know, they are the first line of defense. And if you're willing to kill one of them, what are you willing to do to the average citizen?
All murder is ugly, but this is distinctly brutal and ugly. And, you know, like I said, it yielded very little. What did they gain from that?
What was the point of that? What does that say about their behavior that they didn't just shoot him and then flee? But, and you know, kudos to the production. They really show all these details. And on Criminal Minds, we show a lot of gory stuff too. But because they show Jim Parrick's acting, right, they show him suffering and trying to get up and trying to fight back. You know, it was just excruciating to watch. And I think we needed to see that. We needed to see the kind of person that David Sweat really is.
It balances out all the time that you spend with them, because you see Sweat and Matt as human beings, you know, sort of the drudgery that they go through in prison, the day-to-day struggles that they have, and their sort of, you know, their goal to break out. And it's very difficult to not want to sort of root for them in terms of, you know, they're trying to accomplish a goal. They're making these plans and intricately sneaking around and you know, cutting through steel and all this stuff. And just the thought when they hit that wall, okay, we can get through it in about 5 years.
Right. And the other thing to say about the crime, I mean, they used a pickup truck and actually drove it into the front of the store. So it wasn't a particularly sophisticated crime either, despite the fact we talked about Sweat and we see, you know, the intricacies of the way his mind works and planning and mapping. And he had committed other crimes where he was sort of the architect of it. But this was, you know, sort of a run and gun type of offense. Pickup truck through the front door. There was a careful sketch, apparently, of the place so that they knew where to find what they wanted, which they were after guns. But this wasn't criminally sophisticated in any way. And apparently Sweat had said before that he had basically said that he wasn't going to go back to prison. And therefore, if a police officer ever tried to stop him, that he would shoot the police officer. But yep. That seemed to be, you know, the initial response and the overkill that went with it. And because we hear about him not being violent, you know, and actually that's why he's on the honor block, because he didn't have any blemishes on his record. This is the real Sweat in terms of who he is and what he did. And he had lived a life of crime pretty much since he was young.
Yeah, and there's one criticism I have of the show, actually, that I really bumped on. When they show Paul Dano get out of the car after running this man over and over and dragging his body, they kind of show his face like, kind of, he's sad. He looks a little remorseful. I do not believe for a moment David Sweat got out of his car and was like, sorry, man, I had to do this to you. And I know Sweat sees himself, as you said, Laura, as, I'm not a bad guy. I'm not violent. You are right. A violent murderer. A merciless murderer. I don't care how you see yourself now, you are.
Absolutely.
The other interesting thing was that he had a girlfriend at the time and she helped the police as well. So a number of people did suspect that it was Sweat Narbinger, who was his cousin via his mother, who he actually committed quite a lot of burglaries with. And there was a third man who was with them as well, Sean Duvall, who wasn't charged with first-degree murder.
The fact that Deputy Tarzio's body was not discovered till morning tells us that there wasn't a lot of police activity in the area. The fact that they didn't know where he was at all times and that he hadn't reported in, usually report in as you're going off shift. And if he hadn't done that yet, I don't understand why they weren't out looking for him all night.
And Jim, what is that thing that you told us once about when an officer is killed in the line of duty? What do they do on the radio dispatch?
Well, in the FBI, what they do is they do a call out, and it basically goes something like this. FBI base to unit 114. FBI base to unit 114. Do you read me? FBI base to unit 114. Do you read me? Attention all units, unit 114 is no longer in service. And it's chilling in that, you know, it's the call out, it's the panic that happens basically when a unit is no longer communicating. And usually that's followed immediately by a flurry of activity trying to determine what's going on. If an officer is down, every officer on duty and even off-duty officers will respond to the scene. And it seems like he was unable to make that call. And unfortunately, that meant that Sweat was able to do even more damage and just obliterate Deputy Kevin Tarsia.
And so it's important to say that, you know, Kevin Tarsia acted as a hero that night, and that's how he should be remembered, as a hero. We have many unsung heroes, but he should be remembered and memorialized as the fine officer that all his friends and colleagues talked about him being.
This episode is brought to you by Showtime and the new limited event series, Escape at Dannemora, directed by Ben Stiller and starring Benicio del Toro, Patricia Arquette, and Paul Dano. Based on bizarre but true events, Escape at Dannemora tells the story of two prisoners who broke out of a maximum security prison in upstate New York, and their twisted relationship with the female prison employee who aided in their escape. Thrilling, emotional, dark, and unbelievable. In the town of Dannemora, it's not just the prisoners who are looking for a way out. Watch Escape at Dannemora, now streaming, only on Showtime.
So, we turn from 4th of July holiday, and now we turn to Christmas time in a very different place.
It's December the 3rd, 1997, and we see William Rickerson, who's a 72-year-old man in his pajamas. The carols are in the background, and there's a knock on his door, and we learn that it's Ricky Matt who's at his door, who's desperate to get in to talk to William Rickerson because he wants to apologize to him. We learn that he's been sacked from his job, and William Rickerson was a businessman and a food broker. And when you look backwards at this particular victim and case, William Rickerson had fired him 5 weeks earlier, and it's that reason that brings Ricky Matt to his door, saying that he wants to apologize and wanting to come in and saying that he's doing the honorable thing and wants to, you know, see him face to face. But William Rickerson doesn't want to let him in. And then unfortunately, he talks his way round. And again, that skill that we see, that we understand right. of Matt, right? That he has yeah. the ability to talk his way in to situations and to put people at ease. Just shows exactly, you know, who he is in
how dangerous he is.
Of course, we don't know the full extent of his ability to torture and his enjoyment at this stage. You know, he's apologizing, and once he gets in, then we see a different side. He literally just punches him in the face. He's 72 years old, and we know that, you know, William Rickerson begged for his life and said that he didn't have any money. We know that that Matt goes round there because he thinks that there's money, that there's a safe, and that's what he's trying to get to. However, you know, William Rickerson was 72 years old. He was a businessman and a food broker, so he basically sold food that was about to expire. I can't think that that was too lucrative.
Even though Rickerson was probably well aware of how dangerous Matt was able to talk his way in that door. But I have to say, if he didn't talk his way in, he probably would have kicked it in. He probably would have bashed in the door and done exactly the same thing. He was on a mission. There was nothing that was going to stop him. I don't think he was ever going to just take the money and go. He would have known. He would have ended up in jail in a matter of minutes if that happened. Well, I think he intended to do this all along.
Can I ask you both, does he seem like a very impulsive kind of an offender, though? Because he kind of, you know, gets in there, then he sort of takes the painting and takes the guy. He's in his pajamas. It all seems very impulsive to me.
He wasn't out of prison long, was he? He'd just come out of prison for an attempted burglary and parole violation, and then he started working at William Rickerson's. You know, I wonder how much more this was about revenge. You know, he just strikes me as a man who wouldn't accept no for an answer. And, you know, some of this, yes, it might well be about money, but the revenge side, because there seemed to be too much enjoyment in the whole behavior. And I think that that was played out very well in the show Escape at Dannemora. You know, the fact that he's begging for his life. And Matt, I mean, the way he's been characterized is that he's torturing him and he enjoys it. And that's the sadistic side of him. He was in the car for 27 hours. This 72-year-old man.
They drove all the way to Ohio and back. And, you know, if you listen to what his accomplice said, but that Matt basically would, you know, intermittently beat and torture the guy that they had stuffed in the trunk, hit him with the club, which is a steering wheel locking device, hit him with that repeatedly, and then one day they were driving around for 27 hours, as you said, Laura, looking for the best place to murder and dispose of the body.
Yeah.
So, you know, he wasn't ever going to let this guy go. He kept telling the guy, if you tell me where the money is, I'll let you go, but he didn't do that. But then he just said, you know, I'm bored with this. And he went to the back of the trunk and literally broke his neck.
Right.
Just unceremoniously dispatched him. And that's just so cold and calculating and really falls in line with his psychopathy.
The next part is even more disturbing, though, seeing how he disposes of him, the dismembering of him. I mean, that takes a particular type of person to do that so coldly and clinically. And the way that the show depicts it, I think, is very clever, because you've got the music Bad Company in the background and the really bleak surroundings, what it takes to actually do that. And of course, he's using a hacksaw in this scene, and he's out there, you know, dispatching of William Rickerson as if he's, you know, putting out the garbage, or and that's it really got under my skin, this scene.
Yeah, and you know, we've all seen Benicio del Toro play, you know, tough guys. If you've seen Sicario or anything else, he is absolutely feral in this scene. I mean, he's not even human, you know, the way that he's playing this. And I wanted to ask you, though, in the beginning, what they depict is that they actually dump him, you know, they dump the body in a site, and then later it's like he gets paranoid, and then he goes back and hacks him up.
That's actually very common. When somebody does something that is tantamount to temporary concealment or no concealment at all, and the body doesn't get discovered right away, sometimes they'll go back and they will try to improve concealment. And that's the reason why he went back and basically mutilated the body, cut it up so that it's more disposable. Really, really, again, another indication of how inhuman he treated a human being.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, he disposes parts of the limbs in the river. But the other thing is that he was actually bragging about it afterwards. I mean, he bragged about it to a girlfriend. And so even though he took the time to do that, he's very careless in, you know, who he talks to, you know, people about what he's done, even taking William Rickerson to the strip club, and sort of in a funny way shows the girls, the women that are there, that he's in the trunk of the car. I mean, they were horrified, but it really does again play out just his utter disrespect and contempt for human life.
And that's very impulsive, Lisa.
Yes.
So that tells you this is not a guy who was sophisticatedly planning a way to commit this crime, or the series of crimes, really, and get away with it. This is someone who is reckless and has no respect for the law, no respect for other human beings, and is literally on a high because he's now proving that he has control over his boss who had fired him. This is why people like this just are repeat offenders and will never, ever get straightened out. Never.
And just to say that this revenge kill side to it, I think with, you know, the Matt character, he really is much more about that, this power and control dynamic. And, you know, we know that he fled after committing that heinous murder to Mexico. And he was there for a number of years, but he killed another man, an American, in a bar who was using the restroom. And that individual was someone called Charles Perrault. And that was on February the 20th, 1998. And he stabbed him 9 times in the back and the abdomen. So again, another brutal murder. We don't know exactly what happened, but I would imagine it was some kind of, you know, disrespect issue or power play that he just couldn't, you know, control his own behavior. And so he's incredibly dangerous. And, you know, people who crossed him, he would take revenge on them. And that's that particular crime he spent some time in prison in Mexico for. And then he was brought back to the States. And there's some very interesting other bits of information about him, you know, escaping from Erie County Jail in 1986 as well by scaling a fence, and was on the run for 5 days. And his previous offences after that were for rape and stabbing someone else. So, you know, and assaulting a female.
How is this guy on any honor block? I mean, do you know what I'm saying? It's like, just because he can draw pretty pictures. And only after he murdered Mr. Rickerson, you know, he was on the run for 10 years before they could bring him in. 10 years. And he had a friend who was a cop in the Niagara area who basically let him run. He is such a master manipulator. It's unbelievable to me.
The fact that Matt fled to Mexico and got away for 10 years tells me that when he sobered up after, you know, murdering Mr. Rickerson, he basically realized that he's going to go right back to jail. That, in other words, it was more important to him to be this in control man, to prove his manhood by beating this old man and murdering this old man, torturing him for hours. And then it was for him to stay out in the public and not be put back in prison. So that tells me that he is sophisticated enough, he's experienced enough in crime to know that he needs to get the hell out of town. And he did, and he went to Mexico. And, you know, it's probably a lot easier to be on the lam in Mexico. And when he's there, he can't help himself. And like you said, Laura, it was probably some kind of altercation or some disrespect that this person showed to him. But what does he do? He stabs him in the back, and that's very, very telling. In other words, the guy probably wasn't threatening him. The guy was probably either, you know, just trying to get away, walking away from him, or trying to run away from him, and he stabbed him in the back. And that's up close and personal. It's that kind of wet work that we call. It's very distasteful name. But it's gory doing this. It was gory dismembering Mr. Rickerson. So this is the kind of person he is. And yet, when we see him in action in prison, we see that newbie prisoner coming up and just wanting to talk to him. And the fact that he didn't respect him, that made Matt put him through the ringer, basically, and you know, basically make him, you know, bow down to him and repeat things and make sure that he knew that Matt was in charge. That's the most important thing to him. So his behavior leaks out all this information. He probably feels very insecure, and he needs to prove his manhood all the time.
He's less than, so he has to prove he's more than. And that's what we see across the series. That's congruent about him. And Lee Bates, who was his accomplice when William Rickerson was tortured and murdered over those 27 hours, he said that because he received a 15-year sentence, that when Matt was on the run, he was actually fearful of his own life, because he obviously gave evidence against Matt, and he was fearful that Matt would come after him. So again, you just get a sense that he was this menacing individual, but it could be very charming when he wanted someone to do something for him. Mm-hmm. So much so, he actually persuaded another inmate, someone called David Telstar, to actually pay $15,000 to get him released on bail whilst awaiting trial for rape and assault. And he persuaded him to put up his bail surety of $15,000. So that again just tells you of his ability to charm people and to get people to fall in line, to play to his tune.
When he was talking his way into Rickerson's house, he was definitely intent on at least stealing money and most likely beating, torturing, and killing him. Yet he's able to still control that in himself and project this image of, hey, I'm really sorry. And that makes him all the more dangerous.
Absolutely. The persona that he's able, you know, to use different personas to get what he wants, you know, clear signs and traits of psychopathy. And I think, you know, William Rickerson's son, who's also called William Rickerson Jr., you know, he made an impact statement at court, and he basically felt that Matt should never be released, that he just didn't want another family to go through what he, you know, and his family have suffered. And it also gives us an insight in episode 6 to a younger Tilly, that we have a flashback to Joyce Mitchell. So we go back to August the 13th, 1993, where we meet the young Tilly and her son. And I think there's some very interesting narrative in here, that things that we learn about Tilly that certainly characterises her far more, not just as somebody who was coerced, but somebody who actually does think things through and is strategic in terms of getting what she wants.
And the young Tilly is still played by Patricia Arquette, but boy, what a difference in appearance. I mean, talk about a hot stepper. They play that, you know, here come the hot stepper, and she is 100% the foxy mama, you know, in this. At this point, you can see just a totally different, she carries herself differently, her confidence, it's just so much different than who we meet in the beginning of the series.
Right, so what we did was we actually witnessed in reverse the decline of Tilly and how she went from being sort of a confident, competent person to being someone who was, well, not only manipulated, but vulnerable to manipulation and also manipulative herself. There are so many things that go on in this series with her as a character that it's she's kind of a hybrid, right? Because in one sense, she helped two very dangerous, violent men escape from prison. On the other side of it, she actually was a victim herself, as were her family members. I mean, her husband, Lyle, I mean, he certainly was taken advantage of, and, you know, his life was forever changed by her actions and the actions of Matt and Sweat. So the ripple effect of their crimes just continues to go on and on.
Right, and also her son. You know, I think he's also a real victim in all of this. And we meet him, you know, with young Tilly and son. She's wearing her short dress. And you know, we understand that she works in a factory making moccasins, I think it is, making shoes. You know, and she's with her husband. So we find out that she was married before to someone called Kenny. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about, or Kenny's telling her that maybe she should quit work because childcare is expensive. And he makes more of her. He makes more money than her as a man. So there's a nod to sexism here too, as well. That, you know, him being paid far more than she. Although we don't know how their jobs differ. But you know, some of the factory chatter, you know, about them talking about sex and affairs and lovers and gay men. There's kind of this whole characterization of, you know, mundane life, I guess, again, but she takes, Tilly finds excitement. She seems to find excitement where none exists. And so we learn that although she's with Kenny and she's got Kenny Jr., she's actually having sex with Lyle on the side. And actually, it's not something that's really that secret. You know, it seems that her co-worker knows, and even where they have sex, I was really, you know, sort of surprised. They didn't really try and hide it, did they, what they were doing?
It was like two dogs mating in the, I don't know what that was. I mean, it was so, for one thing, I got a shout out to Charlie Hofheimer, who plays Kenny. Charlie, you know how much I love you. He's auditioned for us a million times. I absolutely love this actor. And you don't know whether to be on his side or not, because it doesn't look like it's an abusive, physically abusive relationship, but there's certainly a lot of conflict. But she seems to have all of these guys wrapped around her little finger. I mean, would you agree? I mean, do you think, see her as kind of a narcissist, and she's just can control anybody? She does not care, who knows, about these affairs. And it's just drama, drama, drama. That she
uses what she can, and you know, in the patriarchy, that's what happens. You know, she wants to be seen, and she wants to shine, and she wants to have attention, and that's what she gets. And you know, yes, the scene where they're having sex in the bushes from behind, it's kind of like comedic in many senses, because there's the young Lyle, played by Mr. Eric Lang, who I really love. I'm going to give a shout out to him, Lisa.
Yay!
A superb actor, and I'm enjoying having various chats with him on Twitter. But we meet a young Lyle, and you know, whilst he's having sex with her from behind, yeah, he's saying the romantic, you know, things about if she were his, then he wouldn't have her pop the hood herself of her car. She's talking about her car breaking down, and even in sex, they're talking about the most mundane thing.
During sex, they're talking about the car. I mean, that's just a great.
That whole dialogue is brilliant, just because it shows, you know, yes, they're sexually active, but just the sort of the level of their lives, but still being sexually aroused. And I thought that was very chivalrous of Lyle to say that, you know, he would pop the hood on her car because, you know, he idolized her and thought so much of her. But then we find out that Kenny's aware of what's been going on, and I think the whole factory probably were, because you could see them. You know, there's no surprise there. You'd actually see them where they all have their smoke and coffee break. They're looking directly onto them in the bushes having sex.
Right.
He confronts her. And, then we have that scene.
Yeah, so Kenny gets her in the parking lot and he's like, how many, you know, how many is it? About, clearly she's done this before. She has a history, I guess, of cheating on him. I got to love the costuming on Patricia. She's wearing these denim Daisy Duke shorts, denim vest, wedges, and her hair is up, and it's just that peroxide blonde, not like your blonde, your lovely blonde, Laura. This is like out of the box peroxide. I don't know what's harder for an actress, to look like that or to look the way that Patricia does in the beginning, because both are kind of... I don't know what to say about that, but it's just amazing visual that she has. Oh, and what does she say? I have the right to happiness. It's in the Constitution. She has the right to be fucking on
there's
the
great dialogue between them. You know, it's interesting. He basically calls her a whore, but says, you know, how dare you humiliate me? That seems to be more what he's worried about, the humiliation of it, and that he wants the kid, which again is an interesting thing that he says he wants, you know, the son. And, you know, Tilly's really, although she's angry with him and shouting at him and cries, she is upset about losing Kenny Jr. as well. So they clearly both loved him. But then we see another side to Tilly start to play out, and we start to understand that, you know, when she's talking to Lyle in the cafe about how upset she is that she wants Kenny Jr. and that actually there may be a way. You can see almost the wheels spinning, that she's found a way, because that she believes that her and Lyle have something special. But she's worried that she's going to be called a whore in court and will be seen as an unfit mother. So starts to hatch a plan. And you get a sense that Lyle's still completely unsuspecting at this point of what it is that she's suggesting, but he does fall in line and he executes a plan, which I'm sure is Tilly is the only architect of. Mm-hmm. And she says that, you know, Kenny can be violent and you just have to rile him up and that's all you have to do. So we have that scene where Lyle goes after him. But before that, you see Tilly walking through, you know, the shop floor. And again, a very confident Tilly kind of, you know, strutting her stuff and her swagger in front of Kenny to set the whole thing up.
Right. So, yeah, they both basically bait Kenny. And Lyle, you know, meets him in the loo. He follows him into the bathroom. And Kenny punches him out, and it's kind of a weird callback to, they have a kind of a similar scene with Lyle and Richard Matt, where Lyle has heard that Matt's, you know, having sex with Tilly and goes to confront him. It's kind of an interesting callback to that scene. But yeah, so what happens? Kenny does get violent. He's goaded and he hits him and he, you know, punches him right in the face, and everybody sees it. And who looks crazy now, you know? Who's the one who looks like the bad guy? But poor Kenny.
Kenny's been set up. But there's a brilliant line just before that happens, which I just wanted to draw our listeners' attention to. When Tilly sits next to Annie, who's the person, you know, her co-worker, who's clearly told Kenny, if he doesn't know by now, what's been going on. Tilly sits down and basically says to her, because she's being ignored, "Your concentration is an inspiration to shoo people everywhere." It's a nice little moment. She does have this kind of funny sense of humour. Whether she genuinely did as a person, or whether this is something that's being characterised by Patricia Arquette and
Ben
Stiller, etc. But I just think there are these, you know, stellar moments of humour.
Yeah, well, it does. It also, Lisa, it really brings out the quality of her acting. I mean, it's the spectrum that she plays from character over the series is pretty remarkable. And I think, you know, no other character has this kind of arc in this series. And I think that's really kind of cool. You know, she did an amazing job. And I think, well, we'll have to talk to Ben about how he cast her and why he cast her.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Oh,
but give her the goddamn awards. I mean, I tell you, you're hearing it first off Real Crime Profile. I mean, she's so deserving because of this. She's utterly compelling, isn't she? As a young Tilly, as the older Tilly, the way she talks, the way she moves, just, you know, as you said, Lisa, even as the young Tilly, you know instantly she's a different, there's a different version of her here.
Yeah, yeah.
Very overtly sexual, but there's a nod to that later on too. But this kind of wily sense, you know, you get more of this wiliness from her as the young Tilly than what you understand later on. You know, if even the scene at the motel when she goes round now to see Kenny and is asking, you know, for money, they've clearly decided, he's decided that he has to settle because it's not going to look good in court. You know, and he calls her a shit whore and says he doesn't want to see her ever again. But the fact that, you know, Kenny Jr. wanted to see his dad, yeah, and she tells him, you know, that you've got a new dad and your daddy doesn't want to see you.
Oh, that was the worst. Heartbreaking. Oh, I hated her for that. Oh,
heartbreaking. God.
You know,
right, but it shows the simplicity in some senses of how Tilly operates, I think. You know, she, everything's moving parts and pieces, and she thinks she can just swap one out for the other.
Right.
And, you know, and that's how she operates, what's in it for her. I don't think there's, you know, we all have traits of psychopathy, actually, Lisa. You know, it's just that psychopaths, yeah, happen to a much more extreme, you know, much more extremity. But yes, Lyle is the new dad, but we get this sense of her loyalty to Lyle. I never forget you took a punch for me. You know, and for her, this kind of cements everything for them. And I'll never forget that. But you get a sense of Tilly, yes, scheming, but smiling at the end. She's got her way. She's got everybody, you know, lined up as she wanted it. And, you know, she's somebody who, as an older Tilly, is quite invisible. You would pass her by, you know, walking down the street, as we've seen in other scenes. But here you have her, you know, basically making sure people dance and march to her tune, but in a very subtle and soft way.
Well, yeah, this last episode is edited within an inch of its life, but I really want to ask Ben or Brett or Michael, that last shot, that long lingering shot on Tilly's face, where she looks almost like a vampire. She's gotten what she wanted. She's just, and it's the longest shot. I mean, I don't know if you remember that shot, Jim, but it must be a minute long. Just on her face and like this slow motion, her little hair like going like this, and her mouth is just open and her teeth. It was a thrilling moment.
But to me, yeah, to me, it's like bookends of how we met her. It was the exact opposite of how we met her, right? It was all a rotating 360 degree shot from behind. Most of the time you spent not being able to see her face. And now this is sort of the reveal of her true self. I thought that real kind of artistic moment, and I think Ben did a great job shooting it.
I want to ask if that's an editing choice, if that was his choice, like, is that, I don't remember if that's in the script. I mean, there's a really long shot on her face. It's like the closest close-up you could ever have, and it's just such a brave, I mean, those kind of artistic choices are very brave to do, in my opinion.
But you know, I thought it was a way for him to sort of put an exclamation point on who she really is.
Yeah, he makes a judgment about her, no doubt about it. Stiller, mm-hmm, and all those, you know, all the creators make a judgment about Tilly in this this part of the episode, that she is a different kind of monster, but a monster.
Well, yeah, I mean, people, behavior is complex. You know, there's so many parts to all of us. So I don't demonize her in this. I just get the sense that she's more strategic than what you might have thought, mm-hmm, at the outset. So it reveals a different depth to her, I think. She's simple in some senses, but there's another, you know, the brain's ticking away to figure out some of the things that she wants and what her desires are. And she executes a plan to make it happen. But actually, there are very nice arcs, mm-hmm, and moments that I would imagine, you know, that Ben Stiller has thought out, because his attention to detail is just so incredible at every point. So I think it is that it's the revealing part that, you know, behavior and human beings are complex and complicated, but there's a simplicity about her too in getting what she wants.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it. That is episode 6. And once again, you know, normally we would want to talk about the victims right up front at the start of a series. But, you know, for obvious reasons, we had to hold back talking about them. But it's just a spectacular episode.
It really is so powerful. And of course, we have so much more to discuss. This is episode 6. I mean, we could talk about each of the episodes ad infinitum. And I know our listeners are really enjoying all of the episodes. So many people are saying that they're listening to the companion podcast and watching the show.
Oh, good.
You know, and that the acting is superb. Some of the things that, you know, we've been talking about and the music, a lot of people are talking about that. So we have much more to come. And I can't wait to talk with Ben Stiller and other people.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm really excited because we're actually going to be interviewing Ben Stiller next. And he's, well, obviously an amazing actor, but he's proven himself, I think, beyond anybody's expectation to be an amazing director as well.
Yeah. And I didn't know he would do something like this. You know, I've just known him for the comedy, you know, certainly the meet the parents, meet the Fockers, who had my family rolling with laughter, you know, for many years. And I had no idea he'd pick up something that's so, you know, real and gritty and actually just turn it into this complete masterpiece. And also just a shout out to Jessica Lee Gagné. I posted an article from the Golden Globe with her, which was superb. Her talking about, you know, being a female cinematographer and the shots that she was trying to get in this particular show. And, you know, she'd moved to France, actually, when Ben Stiller had called her up to say, I really want you to work on this show. And I guess the story really intrigued her, too, as it has done many people. So I'll repost that article because it's really brilliantly written.
I want to give a shout out to my student, Libby Winters. She plays one of the prostitutes who's in that scene. She was my student at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, when I was in a visiting professor there. Go, Libby. You rocked it, and I'm so proud of you. It's a really, really big deal to be cast in something like that. So, good girl.
Well, that's great.
All right. Until we meet again.
Yeah, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org, and there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.